This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome to Radio EcoShock. It's summer, a time on the new planet Earth for more high temperature records in the Northern Hemisphere. Others nearly drown in global wetting. We are all at the mercy of the great stalled waves of the jet stream, my friends. The new normal is there is no normal. The high Arctic ice is melting, more or less unreported. Canadian cities notice the great clouds of smoke coming from the burning boreal forests of the north, unquenched, unseen except by satellite. The same in Russia. Deadly superfires, as predicted on Radio EcoShock, are already with us. It's a perfect time for The Burning Question, a new book by carbon footprint expert, author, and Guardian journalist Mike Berners-Lee. His co-author is a consultant editor for the environment section of the UK's Guardian newspaper and a visiting researcher at the UCL Energy Institute. The authors conclude, the next economic crash may come when the fossil fuel companies are forced to revalue drastically downward. Why? If the public cannot stomach a climate of extinction, more than half of the fossil fuel reserves of the world must stay in the ground. It's shocking, but it's true. Only the business community, pushed by a worried public, can force the politicians into the global agreements we need to ensure our survival. So far, Berners-Lee and Clark say neither conferences, energy efficiency, or alternative energy have had any effect in slowing down the year-by-year growth of greenhouse gas emissions. We find out more in this feature-length interview of Mike Berners-Lee by UK writer and journalist Greg Moffat. Greg has written for the BBC and other publications. Now Moffat has a regular online radio podcast out of the United Kingdom. He calls it Legalize Freedom. As I head out for the hills for my summer vacation, let's listen in as guest host Greg Moffat turns to the burning question.
LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Beyond politics, poverty, and war. LegalizeFreedom.com.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host Greg Moffat, and my guest today is Mike Berners-Lee, co-author of a new book entitled The Burning Question: We Can't Burn Half the World's Oil, Coal and Gas, So How Do We Quit? Climate change is the most fascinating scientific, political and social puzzle of our time. Great minds, enthusiastic leaders and green warriors have all tried to tackle the problem, but so far, the world's efforts at reducing global warming have failed. We do our best to save energy, and technologies have made burning fuels more efficient, but the simple fact is, carbon emissions are still accelerating upwards, following an exponential curve that goes back centuries. Like squeezing a balloon, reductions in one place lead to increases elsewhere. The real barrier to action is that the world has far more fossil fuel in its reserves than it can safely burn. At least twice as much, and perhaps 10 times as much. These reserves are worth tens of trillions of dollars, and solving the problem means persuading the world to abandon them. The burning question asks whether that's possible, and what the side effects might be. Would the global economy sink, and oil companies crash as the carbon bubble bursts? Or could we transition smoothly to a green future? Looking at the whole issue from a fresh perspective, The Burning Question argues that global warming can still be tackled, but only if humankind wakes up to the threat and demands that the fuels stay in the ground. Hello and welcome, Mike, and thank you very much for joining us today on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Hi.
Mike, today we're going to discuss your new book, which you've co-authored with Duncan Clark, and it's called The Burning Question, subtitle, We Can't Burn Half the World's Oil, Coal and Gas, So How Do We Quit? And you point out early in the book that basically human history is essentially history of energy, our relationship with and use of it. Increasingly, in the end of 20th century into the early years of the 21st, we're experiencing a lot of problems around energy, energy security, supply. We see prices for domestic and industrial users climbing. I mean, oil is off its all-time peak, but the trend seems to be in more or less in one direction. And we do need to do something to wean ourselves off our addiction to oil. Difficult, of course, because our industrial civilization depends on it. There's issues around renewables and nuclear, perhaps not showing the promise that we hoped. And of course, there's a threat from global warming, climate change, call it whatever you will. And this, the first stark fact in the book that you present is that for the layperson, it's easy to think that with all this, these issues facing us, that they, quote-unquote, experts are doing something about this. But in fact, fossil fuel use and emissions have both been rising exponentially for more than a century. Now, how on earth do we explain that?
So when we wrote this book because we, out of a sense that some of the big picture analysis of what's the sort of global systemic phenomenon of climate change hadn't properly been flushed out, that wasn't popularly understood. So we set out to write a very big picture analysis, looking, you know, originally we even thought about calling the book The View from Mars because it was taking a very big picture view on it. And when you do that, one of the first things you spot is that global emissions have been rising exponentially since 1850, which is when we've got records from, or decent records, probably before that. And by exponentially, I mean that they've been averaging out at about 1.8% growth per year, every year. And occasionally there have been a few years that are a bit higher than that, but they're always followed by a few years that are a bit lower. It's a remarkably predictable exponential curve. That actually tells us a few very important things. So the first thing it tells us, as you point out, is that nothing that humankind has done to try and cut those emissions has made any detectable difference to that curve. So none of the talk about climate change, none of the global politics about climate change, none of the energy efficiency, none of the national targets or anything like that, that we all hope might be at least beginning to make a difference. None of that has made any detectable difference whatsoever to this very predictable rising exponential curve. So that's the first thing that it tells us. But it also tells us some other equally important things. It tells us that it's likely that energy efficiency isn't going to be, on its own, isn't going to be the solution. Because if you look back over the last 150 years, actually, that's a story of increasing energy efficiency and innovation around energy that's been going on all the time. So 150 years ago, we were using candles, and now we're using LED light bulbs. 150 years ago, we were using coal to drive steam engines, and now we're harnessing energy far, far more efficiently than that. So the kind of popular and obvious thought that an efficiency improvement might cut our overall consumption of energy and maybe our overall need to dig fossil fuel out of the ground is understandable. But in actual fact, when you look at it a bit more closely, it turns out not to be right. The way the dynamic goes, it looks far more likely that actually the more efficiency we've got, the more we find ourselves wanting to use energy because it becomes more useful, and the better able we are to go and dig fuel out of the ground. And so actually, the process of improving our efficiency has actually been feeding that dynamic of increased energy consumption. So that doesn't mean that, that doesn't tell us that efficiency is a bad thing, but it does tell us that on its own, it leads to increased rather than decreased consumption. And the predictability of the curve, the 1.8% a year with, you know, plus or minus not very much, tells us that there's a very fundamental global dynamic at play, in which energy begets energy, and it's like a snowball. Just the bigger it is, the bigger it gets. So we need a different kind of approach to do, if we want to crack that curve, we need a different kind of approach from the sorts of solutions that are usually talked about.
Now, of course, first thought, you don't have to be a mathematical expert, but first thought about exponential curves is that they don't go on forever. So where is this likely to end up? Not so much in terms of all the broad consequences, but just looking at the numbers of this and this way this trend is going.
Well, as you say, all exponentials come to an end. So we know for sure that we're going to be coming off that exponential curve within 600 years, because if we stayed on it for 600 years, we'd be burning all the oxygen in the Earth's atmosphere every single year. So that's clearly ridiculous and impossible. But coming forward to a sort of shorter timescale, we're pretty sure that within 100 years, even if our expectations about what we might discover in the ground, the new discoveries we might make, even if they exceed our expectations, within the next 100 years, we'd run out of everything, every scrap of coal, oil and gas. So we're definitely coming off it in the next 100 years. But actually, you can take that timescale in quite a bit further, because if you look at all the climate change predictions for 2 degrees, 3 degrees and 4 degrees, and nobody knows for certain what sort of temperature is caused by what kind of cumulative carbon emissions, but it looks pretty clear that unless we leave the vast majority of the fuel that we already know about and are already gearing up to extract in the ground, probably for all time, we are at very high risk of taking the temperature to temperature rises which are going to be very dangerous for our species.
Now, we'll come back to the economics and politics of leaving fossil fuels in the ground in a moment, but perhaps you can say something about an all-time carbon budget, because that was a new phrase, a new idea to me.
So there are lots of the exact dynamics of how carbon emissions relate to the climate. It's quite complicated. There are different gases that we put up into the atmosphere, of which the most important one is carbon dioxide. And the more we put up into the atmosphere, the more it drives the greenhouse effect. But equally, there are various compensatory mechanisms that the Earth responds, but there are also positive feedback mechanisms. So there are a range of quite complicated effects. But one quite good approximation is to say that actually, in terms of the eventual equilibrium peak temperature that we'll arrive at, it doesn't much matter when we burn the carbon dioxide. What matters is the total amount that we've burned ever. And the numbers turned out to be pretty good round numbers, in that it looks as though for a 50% chance of staying within 2 degrees centigrade, we need to make sure that we stay within an all-time limit of a trillion tons of carbon, of which we've burned the majority already.
Now, this 2-degree limit that was agreed at the Copenhagen summit in 2009, I believe, but this is all still, as you've alluded to, against a background of great uncertainty, because the climate on the planet, which has always changed naturally, is an incredibly complex system with so many inputs and variables, you know, natural and artificial.
Yes, that's true. I think, you know, for all the numbers that get quoted around about different levels of emissions causing different temperature rises and so on, we need to keep very firmly in mind that actually all this is actually very uncertain. And for all the best modelling in the world, and there's a range of models, and you can take the average of them and so on, and they all try and predict different probabilities of different temperature rises and so on. But the simple truth that they all tell us is that we don't really know for sure the ins and outs of all that. And what we do know is that the more carbon we put into the atmosphere, the more risk we're exposed to. We know those risks are very, very serious. And at a best estimate, if we want a 75% chance of staying within 2 degrees, then we need to keep the vast majority of the fossil fuels that we already know about in the ground for all time.
Now, some people have mentioned a few potential positives in if we take climate change as to read global warming, and you look at some of the potential effects in the book under the headings The Good, The Bad, and somewhat more worryingly, The Beast.
Yes, that's right. So it's easy to think if you live in a fairly chilly and wet part of the world, then it's tempting to think that a couple of degrees temperature rise could be quite nice for some people. But of course, actually, what that means for the whole world's weather systems and what that means for the carrying capacity of the world in terms of its ability to produce food, for example, it's almost certain, especially as you get over 2 degrees, it's almost certain that that's starting to lead to quite serious reductions, for example, in the fertility of the world's land.
Of course, you mentioned that we've got centuries left of fossil fuels, which, of course, one of your key arguments is we can't afford to actually burn those. But centuries are not the low-hanging fruit, so to speak, you know, that oil and other fossil fuels that was easiest to get, of course, was used up first. But we see now some quite extreme things going on. We hear a lot about the dash for gas and shale oil and other conventional sources. And, of course, I recently did a show all about fracking.
And all of those methods, some of the dirtier ones, they have great environmental side effects as well. But they do speak to our addiction and our need for these things. It's almost like any lengths, even though the net energy, you know, energy used up to actually get hold of these fuels, that balance is not always taken into account.
Yes, that's right. So, if you look at the fuel that's in the ground, there's some fuel that we know about and we're pretty confident that it's currently commercially viable to dig out of the ground, and we call those proven reserves. And then there are possible reserves, which there's a probability that they'll be commercially viable at some point. And then there are known resources, which are fuels that we know where they are, but includes fuels that we know about but we don't think are yet commercially viable to get out of the ground. And of course, there's a continuing process of discovery of more fuel and finding out ways in which fuel that used to be uncommercial to get out of the ground can actually become commercial. And as the price, if the price of fuel goes up, then of course that changes the balance and it becomes more worth making more of an effort to go to tap into different reserves. And if you develop a new technology such as tar sands or fracking, then that opens up a whole new set of fuel. So that process is going on all the time, and the total pot that we've got available to us is growing all the time. So the last thing we need is more innovation to get even smarter at accessing some of the harder-to-reach reserves, which, of course, is a process which we're currently investing globally. We're investing a lot of money in.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock's Summer Showcase. This week we are listening to a special online radio podcast called Legalize Freedom with Greg Moffat. Greg is interviewing UK journalist and carbon expert Mike Berners-Lee. The topic is the new book, The Burning Question: We Can't Burn Half the World's Oil, Coal, and Gas, So How Do We Quit?
For those of us in the UK and large parts of Europe, the US, Australia, places like that, and particularly here in the UK, if you lived through the 1980s, miners' strike, it's easy to sort of dismiss coal in our imagination as something that really just isn't a fuel source in any meaningful way anymore. But we look at some of the emerging economies, and particularly China, and some very surprising statistics in your book about the increased use of coal, which, of course, is very dirty.
Yeah, we all think that maybe the carbon intensity of our energy is improving because in this country, at least in the developed world, we hear about renewables and energy efficiency the whole time. It would be very easy to think that the world's energy mix was improving. But actually, if you look at the carbon intensity of the world's energy, it's pretty well flatlining. We think that, if anything, in the last 10 years, it's actually got worse. And the reason for that is that to a very great extent, the developing economies are powered by the most carbon-intensive fuels, and that's coal.
In many ways, fossil fuels compared to, say, for example, other fuels that we've used, like wood, fossil fuels are quite unique in their characteristics and very difficult, if not impossible, to replace. And we have built, since the Industrial Revolution, we have built an enormous and growing infrastructure, including the built environment, transport systems, manufacturing, all the way we provide heat and light, all of which is dependent on oil or other fossil fuels. Now, some of this, it may be possible to convert, but much of it will end up being, if we go in the direction that you're advocating, will end up being obsolete. And there's also the energy cost of actually converting or replacing that. Some experts say it's too late, for example, to use the oil that we would need to convert to solar.
Yeah, that's right. If you take the view that we have to leave, and I think it's increasingly amongst people who really think about this and get to grips with the numbers, I think it's no longer even controversial in some circles now that we need to leave fuel in the ground. If you take the view that we need a global deal that cuts the rate at which fossil fuel is taken out of the ground, which looks absolutely clear, then the question is, well, why is it so hard to bring that deal about? Why are we so wedded to extracting this stuff that it's clearly going to be harmful to do? And one of the answers turns out is that it's worth so much money. So there are tens of trillions of dollars of fuel reserves in the ground, and those reserves are owned by companies who want to dig it up and sell it. And they're owned by countries who balance their books using it. And the UK did that for a while, and America definitely does it. And a host of countries do that. And then on top of the value of the fuel themselves, as you say, there's all the infrastructure. We actually think the infrastructure problem is less serious than the value of the reserves itself. A lot of the infrastructure will go out of date in its own time anyway and will need replacing, and so can be replaced with something that's fit for a low-carbon world. Some of the remaining infrastructure will be adaptable at a cost, but not 100% cost. It may be cheaper than throwing it away and starting from scratch. And even if you have to take something apart, I mean, Hadrian's Wall is still being used. You know, the bricks from Hadrian's Wall are still in houses that are being lived in today. So, you know, it's not 100% write-off even in that case. So we don't think the infrastructure write-off, we think it's serious, but we don't think it's a showstopper.
Now, I think most people will be aware that renewables aren't an unalloyed good. There are issues there. One of them being that they're all actually quite oil intensive in their own way, surprisingly so. It seems somewhat counterintuitive. Nuclear in particular, not only in the wake of Fukushima, but there's always been the issue of how to store and how to potentially process the waste products from that. And I know you mentioned thorium reactors, but there's a question as to whether those, even after all these decades of research, can actually be viable. And then with solar and wind, you know, we get simple protests along the lines of, you know, not in our backyard with wind turbines. And we have solar. I mean, Germany seems to be the only developed country that's doing anything meaningful along solar lines. We had here in the UK, for example, last year that the government's solar panel subsidy was so successful they cancelled it, which was bizarre.
Yeah, I mean, as I say, we hear a lot about renewables, and of course they're a good thing. But in the scheme of the world's energy supply, they are an absolute speck. And frankly, for the foreseeable future, that's about where they look as though they're going to be. So it's not realistic to think that in the next few decades, which is the timescale in which we need to turn our carbon emissions around, we're going to suddenly be able to replace our fossil fuel with renewables. That's not to say it isn't a good idea to push the button on them as hard as we can, but we should be realistic about what they can and can't deliver. As far as the nuclear question goes, I think the details of the policy decision about what the role of nuclear is incredibly complex. Clearly, it's a question of balancing up costs and opportunities and risks, you know, against the alternatives. What would happen if you invested your effort into the alternatives? And I think unless you really roll up your sleeves and do a lot of homework on the specifics of that analysis, it's actually quite difficult to take a position on it. But what I would say about it is this, that the nuclear debate has attracted entrenched positions for decades on both sides. And what we'd urge everybody to do is throw away all their preconceptions about the nuclear argument, because the traditional arguments, as they stood even 10 years ago or certainly 20 years ago, have now changed completely, because we've got a climate change threat that is really big and needs to be taken very, very seriously indeed. And meanwhile, some of the threats around nuclear seem to have mitigated somewhat, and then there's a whole cost equation. It looks as though nuclear is actually quite costly. But I think rather than take a very firm view on it, I think what I'd just encourage is for everybody to be really open-minded, whatever camp you've been on, you know, for the last few decades, however wedded you feel to pro or against nuclear, just we all need to reevaluate that argument.
A lot of the names will be familiar to us, Rio, Tokyo, Copenhagen, and you point out to date there's been something like 18 international climate summits using, I would point out, a lot of CO2. With their private jets, five-star hotels and lobster thermidor or whatever they're having. But there's been a top-down failure, and we see this in the area of energy and climate change. It's almost expected, because we see international summits, for example, now on the financial crisis, and we kind of expect these leaders to get together and kind of shuffle papers for a couple of weeks and go home and achieve very little. But one of the other things, again, that's counterintuitive in the book that you point out is for the bottom-up approach that a lot of people are advocating, that, well, we have to start changing individually and, as you know, in a local community level. These things have a negligible impact, but that's not to say that we shouldn't do them.
No, exactly. I think we want to be very clear about what we're saying here, because I think what we're not saying is we shouldn't do them. And in fact, our conclusion is, in the end, our conclusion is that it is even more important than ever that we do all that kind of stuff at a local scale and more. And the reason is this. So it's clear that we need a global deal on the fossil fuel that comes out of the ground, to cap the fossil fuel that comes out of the ground. And once you accept that conclusion, everything revolves around the question of what would it take to create the conditions under which such a deal would be possible. Now, at the moment, it's clear that the political process is completely lacking, and it's unhelpful. I've heard one or two UK politicians recently saying, OK, we all think the global process isn't going very far, but actually it is showing some signs of beginning to get somewhere. And I think in the context of where it needs to get to, compared to what those signs of progress might be, I think we need to keep a very clear perspective that it really is absolutely nowhere near, even beginning, to look as though it might be leading towards the kind of deal that we need. So the current political process is nothing like what is required. So the question is, what would it take to bring about the conditions under which such a political process really could start to work in a way that might deliver what we need? And when you start asking those questions, I think it takes you to the point of saying, well, how can we bring about a situation in which politicians the world over are fearing for their political careers if they don't get that deal? And they aren't seen to be pushing so hard for that deal that they're part of the reason why it comes about. And what would it take for a politician to feel like that? Well, they probably need to understand that their electorate doesn't just have an armchair concern about it, the kind of concern where when somebody comes up to you with a questionnaire on the street and says, are you concerned about climate change? You say yes. That's not the kind of concern we're talking about. We're talking about the kind of concern where it's actually palpable, that it's finding its way into your behaviours as proof that it will find its way into how you vote. And there needs to be a sense that everybody cares about this stuff. And probably the only way of showing that in a way that is believable is by doing it.
Well, of course, the issue here is that at all levels, nobody wants to give anything up fundamentally. I mean, we see that now since the financial crisis of 07, 08, that even with relatively modest austerity, for example, here in the UK, we see quite out of proportion reactions from the people and also from political leaders on various sides and immediate calls to get back to growth, which is one of the problems.
Yes, I think this whole debate gets unhelpfully framed up around giving things up, because overall, there's no reason why this needs to be a giving up kind of agenda. It's not as though the way that we do life at the moment is fine-tuned for maximizing human well-being. There's plenty of human activity that goes on which trashes the planet and delivers absolutely nothing for human well-being. So yes, it's a time of change. We do need to look at the way we do life in some respects, but the idea that overall it's going to be some cost to how good the experience of being alive is, I think it's misplaced. So there's strong evidence that, at least in the developed world, their economic growth doesn't correlate at all well with well-being. It's not that economic growth is an irrelevant measure, but it's being used for the wrong things. So it's being used as a proxy for everything that matters to us. And it absolutely isn't that, and that is part of the problem. I think it's worth talking about the business case as well, because we hear a lot about the business threat from climate change. So there are certainly some sections of industry that feel a very strong threat to the idea of a cap on the rate of combustion of fossil fuel. So in particular, the oil industry.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock's Summer Showcase. This week we are listening to a special online radio podcast called Legalize Freedom with Greg Moffat. Greg is interviewing UK journalist and carbon expert Mike Berners-Lee. The topic is the new book, The Burning Question: We Can't Burn Half the World's Oil, Coal, and Gas, So How Do We Quit? We'll be right back.